I'm leaving people little choice in terms of how to consume this stuff because, you know, they're coming out so quickly these days. It's really hard. Even for fans of my movies, I think it's been hard to keep up with them. So you sort of almost have to watch them like a season of TV or something. You know, you sort of just like plop down and decide to like catch up on the stuff. But that may change. Well, I don't know. It may be slowing down a little bit.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. Welcome to a very special Fandor-sponsored episode of the show. Today we have Joe Swanberg, who you just heard a clip from him, and he is my sole guest today on the podcast, and this is Joe's third time on the podcast. That's right. I've had him on a couple of times to talk about Drinking Buddies. The first time was, I think, from South by Southwest, and then I had him back on when the theatrical happened here in New York anyway. And now we're back because four of Joe's films are on Fandor, as you'll come to hear a little bit more in just a few minutes. And those films include this trilogy of films that he made about a variation of himself, I guess. And all three films, they're very low budget and they were made very quickly, all came out in 2011, if you can believe it. And they all kind of deal with this filmmaker and filmmaking and relationship between filmmaker and actors and what life is like on the set. And so that's what they kind of share in common. Those films are called The Zone, Silver Bullets, and Art History. And it's capped off by what I consider one of my favorite movies that came out last year called All the Light in the Sky, which stars Jane Addams and Sophia Decal and a bunch of other people. It's a great cast, including Larry Fessenden, and I'm pursuing getting Larry on this podcast. If you're out there, Larry, or if you know Larry, contact me, please, directly, adam@filmwax.com. But back to the show. One thing I really like to do, and I want to get to it before I bring Joe on, and that is to just kind of mention a few films that I've watched that are on Fandor at the moment and that I really, really enjoyed. So call them like my Fandor picks, if you will. One is this great documentary came out in 2010, and it was about the relationship between Godard and Truffaut, two filmmakers that came out of the French New Wave back in the, I think in the 60s. And they were really close friends, and they fell out, in a sense. And this documentary, directed by Emmanuel Laurent, takes a look at that and about the whole time, you know, during this, and also just incredible period of time when these guys, you know, Truffaut started making The 400 Blows, and of course Godard made Breathless and a number of other classics. And, you know, it's interesting talking to friends of mine who are, you know, such fans of this whole period of time and who they lean toward, you know. I personally always lean a little bit more towards Truffaut because I'm kind of more of a sentimentalist, but I have good friends who definitely would lean to the side of Godard. Anyway, I recommend Two in the Wave. Another film, of course, is going way back to the beginning of filmmaking itself. Georges Méliès' film, Trip to the Moon. It was made in 1902. It recently came out again. I think they released it in a restored version. I saw it at Lincoln Center last year. It was great to see it. It's a fairly short a film, but it was groundbreaking in its time, using different techniques that had, of course, basically were being invented by this guy because there was nobody before him. A Trip to the Moon. It's worth reading about afterwards if you can, in terms of how the film was made and the color and all that. I recommend it. Also on Fandor right now is Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which is directed by the Turkish filmmaker Nuri Bilge Ceylan. And it is about a group of men, including some police officers and lawyers, who drive around the countryside in Anatolia and try to track down clues to this dead body they find. And it is remarkable how something so slow and so long can be so involving and engaging at the same time. So if you just don't mind sitting and being patient, it's worth it. And this filmmaker's films, if you're looking for something a little less, economical, the good news is that Nori's former films, Climates and Three Monkeys, is also up there. I've seen them all, and I'm a big fan of this filmmaker. I understand he has a new film coming out. It's, I think, at Cannes right now. So check out Nuri Bilge Ceylan's films if you want to catch up on world cinema. He's one to look for. Last of all, I'm going to mention is a prior guest on this podcast. I think Kaveh Zahedi's been on twice, both times discussing his most recent film called The Sheik and I. Kaveh was commissioned by the Middle Eastern Biennial to make a subversive film, and he did so, and then basically ended up with a fatwa on his and his family's head. This is sort of a film within a film, and the making of, and the outcome of, and it's both infuriating and comical. He got into a lot of deep water and was the cause of a lot of controversy. But that's Kaveh for you. And I understand that right now Factory 25 is releasing, or has already released maybe, a whole box set of Kaveh's works. But you can see quite a few of them right here on Fandor. Okay, so let's get right into the chat with Joe Swanberg. Joe is, as you know, an incredibly prolific filmmaker and very generous and likes to work at a clip. This, again, he has a number of films on Fandor. We're going to talk about all of them in this ensuing conversation. Joe also does have a new film, not so surprisingly, coming out shortly. It's already kind of been working its way through the festival circuit. In fact, it will be, if you live in New York, Happy Christmas will be enjoying its New York premiere with Rooftop Films this summer. So take a look at rooftopfilms.com. And also, I'm pretty sure we'll have Joe back on to talk about Happy Christmas. I just have a distinct feeling. All right, well, here's the conversation with Joe Swanberg, and I'll be back afterwards.
Hey, Sean, is Peg there? It's Marie.
Hey, Marie, hold on. Let me see if I can get her for you. Hold on.
So did you hear?
Yeah, I did. I mean, unfortunately, on the Fox movie, it's not going to happen because they made it off to somebody else.
Who was it?
I think it's Kristen Wiig. I'm trying to find out.
Oh, right. No, that makes sense. Dr. T? It seemed like everybody else was already really successful, and I was this broke, like, girl from New York with, you know, ripped jeans and my dad's overcoat.
Well, I do a monthly episode of the podcast where, you know, Fandor sponsors it, and this would be that.
Cool.
And you've got four features on Fandor, right?
Yeah, I think they have the Full Moon trilogy, and then All the Light in the Sky just went up there the other day.
How did that come about?
Well, those are all films that I'm working with Factory 25 to distribute.
Yeah.
And the three of them, you know, Silver Bullets, Art History, and The Zone are kind of all in dialogue with each other. I mean, they're three standalone features.
Yeah, they work independently, in other words.
Yeah. But you know, they're sort of all these kind of looks at the filmmaking process.
Right. The main character in those three is a variation, let's say, of yourself?
Yeah, they're sort of autobiographical. I mean, it's a caricature of myself is what I would call it. It's kind of, it's a lot of the things that my work has been criticized for. It's a lot of me embodying those, you know, like either the sort of gratuitous sex scenes and nudity. You know, I'm playing the kind of creepy, overly intimate, involved Joe in one. Playing the irresponsible and detached filmmaker and another. You know, I mean, just kind of all of these things I feel like I've read about the work. You know, I'm like, okay, so let's take this criticism and then kind of like dive into that idea.
I understood. So is there like there's almost a satirical nature to it, even though the films are not comedies?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there are... Definitely, The Zone is satirical, and I would even maybe argue that that one is a comedy. And you know, Silver Bullets in art history are much moodier, and but you know, kind of each with their own kind of like dark humor. But yeah, they were sort of all made in this really short window where I produced a lot of stuff, and you know, there's crossover with the actors involved, and definitely thematically, I think all of them are kind of asking the question, with whom does the responsibility lie to make sure that people are safe and comfortable on a film set? You know, like, is it the director's responsibility or is it the actor's responsibility to take care of him or herself? And so, you know, they're kind of all circling around those questions, and then they, of course, get into the reality or artificiality of like emotional connection with other people on a film set. Like, are these real relationships between the actors? Are these real relationships between a director and an actor? Or is everybody just at work? And especially on the kind of small film set that now is very common in American independent film, where, you know, directors and actors are all friends off camera, I think the movies look at how that line gets really blurry.
So conversations that you're having on the set, on the films themselves, not within the movie within the movie, but on the set while you're creating like in this case, this trilogy of films, are you having conversations with the Josephines and the, you know, Sophias and Lindsays of the world? Are you actually discussing this particular issue with them? I mean, obviously you are.
To a really great extent. I mean, we're, you know, sort of in the conception of those projects, it involved a lot of those conversations. And, you know, everybody has their own opinion on it. I feel like those opinions are often reflected in the work itself. You know, I've been making these improvised movies because they allow other points of view in, you know, and because the actors are kind of allowed to be themselves and express their own thoughts and ideas. So, you know, I those movies don't feel like my thesis statements on this stuff as much as they feel like open sort of dialogues and conversations about it. And there's no right answer, you know. I mean, they're not questions that have definite answers to them. So,
to some degree, you're just kind of putting it out there, and
Well, I felt, you know, I mean, coming out of film school, I felt like this was the kind of stuff that nobody ever talked about. You know, I almost wanted to make these movies just to make other filmmakers aware that these are issues they might be confronting, because this kind of way of working didn't really exist when I was in film school. You know, they're the kind of cheap handheld video cameras and portable editing software and, you know, like the festival, sort of regional film festival circuit that shows these movies. Like, all of this stuff was just kind of getting going in the late 90s and early 2000s when I was in film school. So I had classes about three-point lighting and I had classes about screenwriting and directing, but, you know, there was no class about, you know, complicated emotional feelings and stuff, you know. That.
So it's interesting because you're kind of, I apologize for interrupting, I was saying you're kind of working through some therapy in a sense. I don't mean to get too serious about it, but you're working on some issues as a filmmaker and, you know, the guy who's sort of running this set, you know. But the films were made to work on a couple of different levels. It's like they were made to work as entertainments, hopefully, on one level, and then on another, you're speaking in a way, I promise I wouldn't use the term, but in some sort of meta way, you're speaking to other filmmakers and sort of sharing your experiences to kind of create a dialogue or a channel to other filmmakers.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, something like, I don't know, like a movie like Nights and Weekends that I made for that movie and talking with audiences who, you know, were going through long-distance relationships themselves or, you know, related to these characters in some sort of personal way. I feel like I kept saying, like, it belongs at the video store, like, in the self-help section. You know, it's, like, not It doesn't belong in the comedy or drama section, you know. So yeah, but it's just sort of just a different category. I mean, I the thing that's sort of changed about the film industry in the time that I've been a part of it, in the sort of 10 years that I've been actively making work, is that the audiences are allowed to be smaller now. You know, you don't have to make a movie that is for everybody. You can make a movie that's for a pretty small audience, and that audience can find it. And especially on the festival circuit and the kind of audience of other filmmakers, you know, I feel like those movies were all successful in sort of finding their audience.
You're just ignoring the fact that it's completely provocative. You're saying, hey, guess what? I want to cast your best friend Charlie, who I just met 3 hours ago, to play my girlfriend in my next movie. My next movie, which I care so much about. My next movie, which is such a huge part of my life. I think I'd just like to cast Charlie as my girlfriend. As you.
She wouldn't be playing you.
No, she'd be playing herself. Your new girlfriend.
You mentioned before that you were sort of poking fun, or at least were somewhat inspired by, you know, the criticism that you had heard out there. I'm just wondering how much that you really pay attention to it, or if you just kind of worked it through with these three films and have moved on.
I had already moved on by the time I made those three films. I never would have been able to make those movies if I was still sort of actively involved. I stopped reading stuff, I guess, like, right before Alexander the Last came out in 2009, if I'm remembering correctly, so...
Which was your collaboration with Noah Baumbach, right?
Yeah, he produced that one. Yeah, before that it was so exciting just to be written about. You know, I mean, just sort of like growing up wanting movies, it was so amazing that anybody would even bother to review something I had made that I was just reading literally everything that was out there, and there wasn't much of it. And then, you know, as I kind of became a working professional filmmaker and the movies were getting, you know, decent-sized releases from IFC, and there was publicists involved, and, you know, the films were being reviewed in all the major papers and whatever else, you know, it sort of became time to remove myself from that. And I just was, you know, I mean, it just wasn't very helpful to me. That was the big thing. Like, I wasn't really learning anything from those reviews that was useful. And also, I was working so quickly that by the time a film of mine was actually being released and getting reviewed, I had already made one or two others, you know. So I was sort of like, you know, to read a review of Alexander the Last, it was saying, you know, that there was some particular thing that as a filmmaker I was not good at or needed to work on. You know, I sort of already had made other stuff and changed and addressed certain things about my work that I wasn't happy with. And, you know, I mean, it was just like I was too far out ahead of where the kind of critical conversation was that for it to be of much use to me. So, you know, I just kind of like checked out altogether and just stopped reading that. But, you know, I mean, I also stopped for my own kind of health and well-being. It just, the kinds of movies I was making were really easy to attack on superficial grounds. And so it was just like nicer and easier for me to exist in the world with a sort of a lack of awareness of the, you know, sort of cheap shots that people were taking at me and whatever else was going on. And so I just stopped one day. I just decided, like, okay, I'm not going to Google my name anymore, and I'm not going to read any more of that stuff. And it was incredible how quickly it all, you know, how quickly I felt better, and also how quickly that stuff went away. You know, I mean, I realized what a small, tiny bubble of the world it was, you know, this kind of art house cinephile critical community. You know, it's like, it wasn't unavoidable. Like, it's not like I was on the cover of Rolling Stone and I just, like, couldn't get away from the onslaught of commentary, you know? I mean, it was just, like, such a small world of blogs and...
I understand. Yeah, it was very insular, a crowd. Gotcha. And also, as you describe it, it was a very liberating thing to do. And then you could just focus on the work of making organically inspired films as opposed to worrying about the rest.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even the impulse to comment on the commentary is probably not that useful. You know, like, in the making of Silver Bullet's Art History in the Zone, like, even that is sort of, you know, insular commentary in such a specific kind of way. So yeah, I think I'm just like, now I'm just interested in making work and connecting with as wide an audience as possible, you know. It's, oh yeah, like making work and connecting with as wide an audience as possible is the thing that was initially exciting to me about filmmaking, and, you know, I sort of got lost in the sort of cinephile bubble for a little while, and making Drinking Buddies especially was just a chance to emerge from that very insular, felt like a very stifling kind of environment of just festivals and critics.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, just a world that I had, like, been living in for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
In a way, it feels like there's a through line from that trilogy to Drinking Buddies with All the Light in the Sky. There, you could see sort of you've got one sort of leg in, you know, in one of the, when that, in that space, and then your other in a different space, you know? Like you're merging into a new phase of storytelling, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I made All the Light in the Sky a few months before we made Drinking Buddies, and, you know, it's definitely unconnected. I mean, there's, like, a nice connection in the sense that it's, you know, the characters are also artists and involved with filmmaking, and so there's, again, that sort of meta kind of level involved, but yeah, it just feels so much more open to me, and it feels concerned with the world outside of itself more than the other three, you know. And that's exciting to me. You know, I mean, the other thing that happened in the meantime is that I had a kid, you know, and so...
There's that,
which, like, really informs All the Light in the Sky, I think, in a big way of this kind of concern with happiness and the environment and, you know, just a bigger, broader world outside of my own kind of selfish pursuits.
And how is that part of your life going?
It's been amazing. I mean, I would say I'm a totally different person. You know, ever since my son was born, I feel like I'm a lot more sensitive and emotional and, you know, engaged in other people, like the whole process. Do you have any kids?
Yes, I do. I have a son myself who's turning 10 in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I feel like the process of, like, raising a child is one of having to let go of a lot of selfish shit that you got comfortable with. You know, like, it's definitely frustrating, but you sort of can't be the center of your universe anymore. And for me, that was a really positive experience to sort of be thrust out of the middle. And suddenly this other person is the center for a little while. And, you know, it's, there's a lot of growing pains involved, but, you know, as an artist, I feel a lot more engaged with other things, you know, and other people and other stories, and that's all been really nice. And, you know, I suspect it'll be cyclical. Like, I don't think Silver Bullet's Art History in the Zone were a fluke. You know, I think that I'll probably return to those themes, but, you know, they'll probably circle back, and I'll attack them from a different angle next time. And, you know, I'm still interested in the filmmaking process, and I think that there's something about the making of movies that's inherently cinematic and interesting as the subject matter for movies. But, you know, it'll each time I kind of revisit that territory, it'll probably be the characters will be older, and I'll be coming at it from a different point of view.
Well, that's another great thing about watching a career artist is to, as somebody who's watching the films, you know, you get to go kind of go on this long journey. And it's good to know that you're in a space in your head and in your creative context that you are just making films that are, again, more kind of coming from an organic place, because in so many cases, a lot of directors are doing works for hire. There's not a whole lot of directors out there that are kind of just doing this. I mean, kind of like what Woody Allen did and John Cassavetes, whose, you know, life was kind of cut short a bit. We look at those artists because it's like we felt we had a, you know, an investment in a way, you know, that, and I can speak personally and say that's why I personally like your films, because I'm looking forward to seeing what's next, you know? Yeah. And that actually leads me to Happy Christmas, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm kind of really curious to do so, because, again, of course, for the entertainment of it, but also to see, well, where is Joe's head at?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's very much along the path of that journey. I mean, Happy Christmas is about, you know, this, like, Melanie Lynskey and I play this couple, and we're both artists, mm-hmm. and we have a 2-year-old, and, you know, I mean, it's really present and relevant to my life right now, and, you know, I mean, but rather than focusing on my side of that struggle and issue as a filmmaker, it's really focused more on Melanie Lynskey's character and her struggle of, you know, identifying as an artist, but then in reality sort of being a stay-at-home mom and having a hard time wrapping her head around, you know, sort of what that means for who she is. And, you know, that's subject matter that I feel like I never see in movies, but was certainly something that my wife Chris, who's also a filmmaker, was dealing with. And, you know, our situation was such that we didn't have any money, and, you know, I was sort of in a position where I could make a little money easier than she could, and we couldn't afford childcare. You know, I mean, I feel like it's a situation a lot of families around the world are in, you know.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the way that worked for our particular was that I ended up buckling down and having to make a little bit of money, and she ended up staying home with Jude. And, you know, I mean, it was just complicated. We were both used to just doing our own thing, and
it's an enormous it's the most enormous sacrifice, and how people navigate that is often potentially dictates how the rest of your marriage is gonna, and what your family is going to look like for the rest of its life. Absolutely,
no doubt about it. So it was really fun, you know, I mean, it was just really fun to dive into that, and I think that, you know, it's a sign, it's like, as we're talking about it, you know, I'm kind of realizing that it's definitely a sign of my sort of changing outward look, because, mm-hmm. you know, a couple of years ago, I probably would have attacked that subject matter by looking at myself and, you know, sort of asking how having the kid affected my filmmaking and my process. And instead, you know, it's much more focused on other people, and I'm in there and my point of view is in there, but it's in a minor role, you know, it's sort of in a supporting role. So yeah, I'm really excited for people to see it. I think it's a conversation that's going to hopefully be pretty close to home for a lot of people. And hopefully it, you know, sort of creates some interesting dialogue.
I also, I just wanted to squeeze in, I just also had Zach Barker on the show, and have to say it was interesting also to see you in kind of a different role in that movie, Proxy. That was great. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, my accidental acting career has been really exciting for me. You know, it's not anything I ever would have suspected I would be doing, but, you know, it's been, as a director, it's been really amazing to sort of have access to so many other filmmakers' sets, and, you know, to just kind of be able to experience the filmmaking process from that side of things. But additionally, you know, I do like acting a lot, and so it's been really rewarding that, you know, people are asking me to do it. And it's funny to me that it's mostly horror movies, you know. Yeah. I think it's
you got typecast somehow along the way.
Exactly. But I love it. You know, I mean, it's actually like a really cool genre to have landed in. If I was if I was acting in a lot of movies that felt like my movies, that might start to get a little weird and complicated. But to be making these sort of small relationship movies and then to be acting in these sort of much bigger, broader horror movies has been really cool.
So you're in the, so having said that, we can also mention you're in the new Ty West Sacrament, and I guess I'm assuming you're in the new Adam Wingard film. I'm assuming, maybe I'm wrong.
I'm not in The Guest.
Oh, you're not in The Guest. How did that happen? We'll have to make a note here. And
I've gotten so busy as a director now that most of my friends don't even bother asking because they know that I'm going to be working almost all year long on my own stuff. But so yeah, my acting career may actually be tailing off just as it's getting started. But yeah, it's The Sacrament was definitely like the longest, sort of biggest role I've ever had in somebody else's movie, and we shot that down in Savannah, Georgia. I think I was there for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes out really soon. I think it comes out this Friday on VOD, and it'll be out in theaters after that. But yeah, it's really, Ty and I have worked together a lot over the years, and, you know, we met each other at South by Southwest in 2005, so that was, you know, 10 festivals ago. So, you know, it's kind of cool that like, our decade of filmmaking, which sort of intersected a lot and Ty's acted in a lot of my movies, it was cool to sort of return that favor and kind of go down there and do that thing in his movie.
I guess the last thing should make some sure. Again, those three movies, or four of your films, rather, the trilogy, The Zone, The Silver Bullets, and Art History, and All the Light in the Sky are all on Fandango. People can binge watch your films now.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I'm leaving people little choice in terms of how to consume this stuff because, you know, they're coming out so quickly these days. It's really hard, even for fans of my movies, I think it's been hard to keep up with them. So you sort of almost have to watch them like a season of TV or something. You know, you sort of just like plop down and decide to like catch up on the stuff. But that may change. Well, I don't know. It may be slowing down a little bit. It's hard to tell. I keep sort of feeling like I am naturally slowing down, and then I also tend to keep ending up making more movies.
Yeah, I understand. It's a curse.
There's no real model for, like, putting out more than a movie every 2 years. You know, I mean, it's really the cycle that a movie takes. I mean, Drinking Buddies is sort of the first thing that I made that really had a full cycle. You know, it kind of had a really nice, decent theatrical run, and then, you know, hit like DVD and home video, and then sort of had all, you know, it's the first movie of mine that was in Redbox and kind of did all that like home video stuff, and then it hit Netflix, and now it's sort of like international thing is happening, and, you know, I'm realizing that you know, that really is like a 2 year cycle before people, you know, before it feels like everybody who wanted to watch it has had the opportunity to see it in some platform or another. But
the difference is, Joe, is that while all the other filmmakers complain that during that two, you know, that cycle that you just described, that they're not being able to make films and be creative because they have to travel with the film and they have to, you know, be part of the marketing plan and they have to do all this work and then they miss out on making other films, whereas you're somehow or other figured it out, albeit it's one film you're talking about, I suppose. But
it's, well, you know, I mean, I sort of knowing that, I mean, I knew that I wanted to give Drinking Buddies a lot of my undivided attention. I was really proud of it, and you know, it sort of, it felt like it stood a chance of really connecting with people, and so, you know, I didn't want to shortchange the movie, but I also, you know, I'm always eager and anxious to make work. So I actually did, you know, I shot Happy Christmas before Drinking Buddies, so, you know, it was kind of like already, and I'm glad I did because, you know, Happy Christmas was shot in December of 2012, and I didn't make anything all of 2013. You know, that entire year was definitely occupied by Drinking Buddies. So I understand filmmakers' frustration with kind of, you know, if you're going to commit to getting your movie out there, something else. So, yeah, well, I think there will be a kind of a natural little bit of a slowdown with certain things, but I'm also trying to figure out how to make movies really fast so that they don't take the typical, like, 2 months of pre-production and shooting. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to make movies in 2 weeks, you know. So
my gosh. Well, don't slow down on my account. What were you going to say? I'm sorry, what?
Roger Corman continues to be an inspiration, you know.
No doubt.
He made Little Shop of Horrors in 2 days, so I still feel like I have a lot to learn.
That's true. I was going to say before that you talked about this two-year cycle, and I was going to say, you know, you did the whole festival, theatrical, digital, on-demand, that whole, you know, cycle. But you left off the adaptation of Drinking Buddies into a Broadway musical. That's yet to happen. So you may still be back.
That's right. Yeah. I'm not holding my breath, but you know, the craft beer. As long as everybody in the audience got like 2 pints of craft beer, I think I could go along with it.
Well, thank you again. I don't know. It just seems that you're now a regular guest on my podcast, which is, for me, a treat. I appreciate it. And
yeah, man, no problem.
We'll no doubt, as Happy Christmas comes through, maybe I'll catch up with you again. I would look forward to it.
Yeah, can't wait, man.
That's going to be a rooftop, actually, so I know you will.
It is, yeah, and it's going to be it's playing BAM and...
Well, I guess if you're listening, you can see most of the films we've just talked about on Fandor, which I think is a great way for independent film lovers. I think it's a great place for your work to end up, frankly, because they do independent film and festival films with love and care, and so I think it's a great relationship that you have with them.
Yeah, I totally agree. It definitely seems like the movies are finding an audience there in a way that isn't necessarily happening on other platforms. So,
and no disrespect to other streaming companies, but I, you know, they're putting also a context with your films. You know, they're gonna want people to have that kind of festival experience online, whatever, you know, as close as they can get without.
I think they're smartly realizing that there is there is this sort of other audience that is on the festival circuit all year long and paying attention, reading Filmmaker Magazine and paying attention to smaller movies. And so, building a community of that audience makes a lot of sense, and that audience is definitely growing every year. So,
well, thanks again. And continued luck and success with the films and with Chris and Jude and everything else, man. It was good to talk to you. All right.
Yeah, you too, right?
All right.
All right.
Take care. And there you are. I'm not really quite certain who's my next Fandor-sponsored episode guest. I'm figuring it out now. As soon as I know, I'll let you know. But it's been a joy and a pleasure working with those folks over at Fandor and with Ted Hope and his peeps. Keep an eye out for it, because I do believe that, as blatant as this sounds, I do really have a place in my movie-loving heart for this organization. So I strongly recommend giving it a shot. You can get a 2-week trial subscription with Fandor, and if you like what you're experiencing, I think for not very much money, you can get a monthly subscription to the site and enjoy lots and lots and lots of independent films. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back later this week with an all-new episode of Filmwax Radio. Until then, take care.